nonentities. Perhaps foremost in the investigation of selfism and egology is the field of neuroscience. Therein may be found a dense and technical literature antithetical to the everyday world of the everyday self. In Being No One, for example, the German neurophilosopher Thomas Metzinger provides a theory of how the brain manufactures the subjective sense of our existence as discrete selves, even though, as Metzinger explains, we would be more rigorously categorized as information processing systems, for which it is expedient in an existential sense to create the illusion of being someone. In Metzinger's schema, a human being is not a person, but a mechanistically functioning phenomenal self-model that simulates a person. The reason we cannot examine these models is that we see through them, and so cannot see the processes of the models themselves. If we could, we would know there is nothing to us but these models. This might be called Metzinger's paradox. You cannot know what you really are, because then you would know there is nothing to know and nothing to know it. What now? So, rather than be know-nothings, we exist in a condition of what Metzinger describes as naive realism, with things not being knowable as they really are in themselves, something every scientist and philosopher knows. The sketch of Metzinger's central thesis is transparently inadequate, though necessarily so in the present context. By his reasoning and intuitions concerning the nature and workings of consciousness, Metzinger has no equal in his field, and impresses one as a thinker whose speculative investigations will someday prove to be the way of reality. By argument and analysis, he has taken consciousness studies as far as possible by the resources available in the early 21st century. The project Metzinger has taken upon himself is precisely of the kind whose import is not restricted to the halls of science, but is pursued for the far-reaching implications it may have with regard to the life of the average mortal. That said, the following discussion of Metzinger has an ulterior purpose, having little to do with the value of his theories. In his essay, The Shadow of a Puppet Dance, Metzinger, Ligotti, and the Illusion of Selfhood, James Trafford breaks down Metzinger's paradox as follows. The object, man, consists of tightly packed layers of simulation, for which naive realism becomes a necessary prophylactic in order to ward off the terror concomitant with the destruction of our intuitions regarding ourselves and our status in the world. Conscious subjectivity is the case in which a single organism has learned to enslave itself. The closing quote from Metzinger's Being No One might be seen as an extension of Zapfe's paradox, by dint of which we repress from our consciousness all that is startling and dreadful in our lives. For Metzinger, this repression takes the form of the aforesaid naive realism, which masks the single most startling and dreadful revelation for human beings, that we are not what we think we are. Assuaging our qualms about such a deplorable enlightenment, Metzinger avers that it is practically impossible for us to attain realization of our unreality due to inbuilt manacles of human perception that keep our minds in a dream state. An interesting fact that seems relevant to Metzinger's study of the illusion of selves is the following. Metzinger is a lucid dreamer. His treatise, Being No One, contains an entire chapter on the knack of being able to wake up in one's dreams and recognize that one's consciousness is operating within an illusory zone created by the brain. In that aspect of our lives where we have no say in what happens and are free to choose nothing, the lucid dreamer is no one's fool, or at least not his own. He has peeked behind the curtain of what his consciousness has made and seen through its tricks and traps. This faculty might very well explain Metzinger's inquisitiveness about the nature of waking perception and the possibility that, as Poe wrote, all that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream. These lines sum up the argument of Being No One, that we sleep in the self and cannot awake. Yet at the close of this 699-page work, following hard upon an examination of how and why human beings evolved in such a way that we believe we are someone while actually being no one, there seems to be some hedging. At least in principle, Metzinger writes, one can wake up from one's biological history, one can grow up, define one's own goals, and become autonomous. So imponderably nebulous, the meaning of these sentences can only be guessed at, since Metzinger leaves them hanging in the air. One is unreservedly stymied as to how this transformation could occur in terms of Metzinger's theory and research. Did he wrap up his treatise prematurely? Does he know something he is not telling us? Or did he just want to end a disillusioning book on an up note? The same year that he published Being No One, Metzinger further clouded the issue. In a lecture at the University of California, Berkeley, he referred to our captivity in the illusion of a self, even though there is no one to have this illusion, as the tragedy of the ego. This phrase fits like a glove into Zopfa's theory of consciousness as a tragic blunder. Disappointingly, Metzinger goes on to say that the tragedy of the ego dissolves because nobody is ever born and nobody ever dies. This statement is borrowed from Zen Buddhism, the Heart Sutra, and loses something when translated from a monastery to a university lecture hall. In traditions of enlightenment, the only redress for our fear of death is to wake up to our brain's manufactured sense of self, and thus eliminate what we mistakenly think we are before it is too late. But Metzinger's mission as a scientist philosopher has been to shed light on the neurological mechanisms that make this goal unfeasible. Why, then, does Metzinger speak to his auditors about the tragedy of the ego, which in all probability none of them thought to be a tragedy before coming to his lecture, and how it dissolves because nobody is ever born and nobody ever dies? He seems to be trying to alleviate any fears they might have about their death, at the same time he is telling them that they do not exist in the first place. Either way, something is lost that everyone cannot help wanting to hold on to, tragic as that may be. Metzinger's whole routine seems to be based in the same kind of paradoxical double-talk that the world already lives by, so as to deny the suffering it must endure, and to continue to believe that consciousness is not a problem, and that being alive is all right. But let us not jump to conclusions. In an online forum in which some of the most prestigious figures in consciousness studies responded to Nicholas Humphrey's A Self Worth Having, where, as quoted earlier, Humphrey says that consciousness is a wonderfully good thing in its own right, Metzinger sums up his own position on this subject. Here he tolls the same bell as Zopfa when he writes, "It is not at all clear if the biological form of consciousness, as so far brought about by evolution on our planet, is a desirable form of experience, an actual good in itself." The theoretical blind spot of current philosophy of mind is the issue of conscious suffering. Thousands of pages are being written about color qualia, or the contents of thought, but almost no theoretical work is devoted to ubiquitous phenomenal states like human suffering, or simple everyday sadness, subclinical depression, or to the phenomenal content associated with panic, despair, and melancholy, let alone to the conscious experience of mortality or of losing one's dignity. The ethical normative issue is of greater relevance. If one dares to take a closer look at the actual phenomenology of biological systems on our planet, the many different kinds of conscious suffering are at least as dominant a feature as our color vision or conscious thought, both of which appeared only very recently. Evolution is not something to be glorified. One way, out of countless others, to look at biological evolution on our planet is as a process that has created an expanding ocean of suffering and confusion where there previously was none. As not only the simple number of individual conscious subjects, but also the dimensionality of their phenomenal state spaces is continuously increasing. This ocean is also deepening. For me, this is also a strong argument against creating artificial consciousness. We shouldn't add to this terrible mess before we have truly understood what actually is going on here. To the relatively observant eye, there seems a disparity between Metzinger's conclusion of his book and Berkeley lecture and his online exchange with his colleagues. One could speculate that he felt more comfortable expressing his misgivings about the evolution of human consciousness in a cyber-convocation of his peers than in his high-profile opus and public appearances. In the former outlet, he pulls no punches when he says, "There are aspects of the scientific worldview which may be damaging to our mental well-being, and that is what everybody intuitively feels." This is a breathtaking statement for a well-credentialed philosopher to make, as was his inquiry quoted earlier about whether someone could really believe in determinism without going insane. What else could Metzinger mean by this utterance, other than that well-used caveat of horror fiction that we are in danger of knowing things we were not meant to know? And the worst possible thing we could know, worse than knowing of our descent from a mass of microorganisms, is that we are nobodies, not somebodies, puppets, not people. In a later book, The Ego Tunnel, The Science of the Mind and the Myth of the Self, Metzinger confronts the problems involved with breaking the news to the average mortal that he or she is actually an average phenomenal self-model and not a person. He wants to assure people that this is not a secret too terrible to know, but a truth that will set us free to be better human beings once we settle on what is a human being, since to Metzinger we are not what we think we are, and once we decide what should a human become, which is a knotty issue in light of how this decision should be made and who should make it. One of Metzinger's fears is that some people will sink into what he contemns as vulgar materialism and will conclude there is nothing for them in this life but survival, reproduction, and death, with the wise guys of the world saying to themselves in Metzinger's imagined soliloquy, "I don't understand what all these neuro-experts and consciousness philosophers are talking about, but the upshot seems pretty clear to me. The cat is out of the bag. We are gene-copying bio-robots, living out here on a lonely planet in a cold and empty physical universe. I get the message, and you had better believe I will adjust my behavior to it." This strategy seems to be that of heroic pessimists like Miguel de Unamuno, Joshua Foa Dienstag, William Brashear, Friedrich Nietzsche, and any number of others who are already in the know. It is surely the strategy that Zapfe observed everyone to be following, the strategy that we must follow if we are to go on living as paradoxical beings who know the score but tamp down their consciousness to keep from knowing it too well. And it works well enough to keep us living as we have all these years. But could the vulgar materialist actually say that he or she is aware of being no one as a fact, and still go on to pretend that he or she is someone? Would this not be another version of Metzinger's asking, "Can one really believe in determinism without going insane?" Would such a mental state not only be practically impossible, but totally impossible? Just as it would be impossible for someone to say, "I am nothing but a human puppet," and continue to live as he or she had lived before? It does not seem likely that you could ever see yourself as what you are, per Metzinger. You would then know the horror, and know that you know it. No longer would it be impossible to believe that you are nothing but a human puppet. What now? Answers. Now we go insane. Now our species goes extinct in great epidemics of madness, because now we know that behind the scenes of life there is something pernicious that makes a nightmare of our world. Now we know that we are uncanny paradoxes. We know that nature has veered into the supernatural by fabricating a creature that cannot and should not exist by natural law, and yet does. Metzinger's derision of vulgar materialism seems to rest on his optimistic belief that a future technology of consciousness will take us places where the biological form of consciousness, as so far brought about by evolution on our planet, has not taken us. Beautiful and wonderful places, in Metzinger's admittedly well-informed and extraordinarily humane opinion. If we do not yet know what it is to be human, we have a ballpark idea of what it is to be humane, and Metzinger's preoccupation with the suffering of sentient beings matches that of any pessimist. The only difference is in his opinion of how we may eliminate or greatly ameliorate this suffering. In any event, while Metzinger has been audacious enough to state that there are aspects of the scientific worldview which may be damaging to our mental well-being, and that is what everybody intuitively feels, he himself feels that everybody may not always feel that way, and that the risk-benefit calculation will add up in our favor. What else could a neurophilosopher believe? That we should give up on ourselves and go extinct? Metzinger must have faith that once the rest of humanity has seen through the game, we will, in all sincerity and not as pretenders, play through to a world in which, day by day, in every way, we are getting better and better. But that will take time. Lots of it. Even in the 21st century, there are people who are incapable of abiding Darwin's theory unless they can reconcile it with their creator and his design. Losing hold of these shielding eidolons would make them honor-bound to become unhinged, so they might say, because the world as they know it would molder away in their palsied arms. Unprepared to receive the evidence, they run from it as any dreamer runs from a horror at his heels. They think that when this horror closes in on them, they will die of madness to see its shape and know the touch of what they believe should not be. No doubt they would survive the experience, as so many have done before them. We have already weathered torrents of knowledge we were not meant to know, yet were doomed to know. But how much more can we take? How will the human race feel about knowing that there is no human race, that there is no one? Would this be the end of the greatest horror tale ever told? Or might it be the reinstatement of the way things had been before we had lives of our own? For now, those who cannot abide even Darwin's theory without the Creator beside them seem to be safe. To quote Lovecraft on the subject of forbidden knowledge, "The sciences, each straining in its own direction, have hitherto harmed us little. But perhaps they will one day. Then the time may come to engage Zapfe's solution for saving the future from the curse of consciousness." While we wait breathlessly for the test results of neuroscientists, people will still be knocking on your door to hawk some gimmick that will get you into their heaven. Naturally, these salesmen of the sacred do not have a clue regarding what things are like in heaven. Are there levels of heaven? Could someone be in heaven and not know it? And how often have we heard that many who are alive today will not taste death, but instead will proceed directly to paradise when the rapture is upon us? This means that billions have already dropped dead with the unfulfilled hope of not having to suffer the throes of the unsaved. What disillusionment must have incommoded them as they lay in extremis? Death would not be so bad if we could just disappear into it without any irksome preliminaries. But even those who expect the doors of heaven will open for them would prefer not to make their entrance after the physical trials of fighting for the life that God gave them. For the rest of us, the carousel of consciousness spins round and round, enlightening us only to the blood-curdling probability that the worst will likely be saved for last. And even those who experience being alive as quite all right will have to live through such tacked-on endings as dying in a vehicular misadventure or lying abed sucking tubes. Life is like a story that is spoiled by an unsatisfactory resolution of preceding events. There are no retroactive fix-ups for the corpses we shall become. All's well that ends well, is well enough in the short run. In the long run, as British economist John Maynard Keynes reportedly stated, we are all dead. This does not sit well with us by way of an ending. But it is not as if we can choose how things will end for us, or for those yet unborn. Unpersons. In his novel translated as Moment of Freedom, which was published 10 years before his suicide in 1976, the Norwegian author and cultural critic Jens Bjørnbo wrote that he who hasn't experienced a full depression alone and over a long period of time, he is a child. Aside from being indemonstrable in its validity, Bjørnbo's bilious discharge is also too restrictive in esteeming his personal class of suffering as the sole rite of passage to maturity as a conscious individual. Depression is only one of the psychopathologies that could be selected to make the bombastic claim that those who have not been affected by it in full and over a long period of time belong on a playground or in a playpen. But it is serviceable as an example of a psychological disease with which most people have had some experience in one or more of its varieties. The statistically prevailing form of this disease is atypical depression. Less common and more deadly is melancholic depression. But whatever family name a given case of depression goes by, it has the same effect, sabotaging the network of emotions that make it seem as if you and your world mean something in some meaningful way. It is then you discover that your old self is not the inviolable thing you thought it was, nor is the rest of your old reality. Both are as frail as our bodies, and may be perforated as readily, deflating all that we thought meaningful about ourselves and our world. What meaning our lives may seem to have is the work of a relatively well-constituted emotional system. As consciousness gives us the sense of being persons, our psychophysiology is responsible for making us into personalities who believe the existential game to be worth playing. We may have memories that are unlike those of anyone else, but without the proper emotions to liven those memories, they might as well reside in a computer file as disconnected bits of data that never unite into a tailor-made individual for whom things seem to mean something. You can conceptualize that your life has meaning, but if you do not feel that meaning, then your conceptualization is meaningless and you are nobody. The only matters of weight in our lives are colored by rainbows or auroras of regulated emotion which give one a sense of that old self. But a major depression causes your emotions to evaporate, reducing you to a shell of a person standing alone in a drab landscape. Emotions are the substrate for the illusion of being a somebody among somebodies, as well as for the substance we see, or think we see, in the world. Not knowing this ground-level truth of human existence is the equivalent of knowing nothing at all. Although varying in intensity and nature, our emotions must seem ever stable in their concatenation, just as a mixed drink must be made with specific ingredients in the same relative amounts so that they may blend into a vodka martini or a piña colada. United, our emotions ostensibly form a master self to which anomalous secondary selves may be compared for quality. Even as they are ever trading places or running together within us, clearly cut or amorphous, the experience of these biological twitterings makes it nearly impossible to doubt that they will stay with us as far as we can see into the future. Ask any couple who cannot imagine being without each other, a vital fiction without which, besides the fact that it often leads to procreation, no society could exist. It would have no reason to do so, because reason is merely the mouthpiece of emotion. Hume, who specialized in detaining his readers with obvious but unspoken realities, wrote in his treatise of human nature that reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions. To free reason from this slavery would mean our becoming rationalists without a cause, paralytics crippled by mentation. In speaking of depression and its defining effect of driving its victim to the point of caring nothing for anything, the American talk show host Dick Cavett once remarked that, when you're downed by this affliction, if there were a curative magic wand on the table 8 feet away, it would be too much trouble to go over and pick it up. No better elucidation has ever been proffered vis-à-vis the uselessness of reason in the absence of emotion. In the recumbence of depression, your information-gathering system collates its intelligence and reports to you these facts. 1. There is nothing to do. 2. There is nowhere to go. 3. There is nothing to be. 4. There is no one to know. Without meaning-charged emotions keeping your brain on the straight and narrow, you would lose your balance and fall into an abyss of lucidity. And for a conscious being, lucidity is a cocktail without ingredients, a crystal-clear concoction that will leave you hungover with reality. In perfect knowledge, there is only perfect nothingness, which is perfectly painful if what you want is meaning in your life. William S. Burroughs said it rightly in his journals. Using his streetwise voice, he wrote, "Love, what is it? The most natural painkiller what there is." You may become curious, though, about what happened to that painkiller should depression take hold and expose your love, whatever its object, as just one of the many intoxicants that muddled your consciousness of the human tragedy. You may also want to take a second look at whatever struck you as a person, place, or thing of beauty, a quality that lives only in the neurotransmitters of the beholder. Aesthetics? What is it? A matter for those not depressed enough to care nothing about anything? That is, those who determine almost everything that is supposed to matter to us. Protest as you like, neither art nor an aesthetic view of life are distractions granted to everyone. In depression, all that once seemed beautiful, or even startling and dreadful, is nothing to you. The image of a cloud-crossed moon is not in itself a purveyor of anything mysterious or mystical. It is only an ensemble of objects represented to us by our optical apparatus, and perhaps processed as a memory. This is the great lesson the depressive learns. Nothing in the world is inherently compelling. Whatever may be really out there cannot project itself as an affective experience. It is all a vacuous affair with only a chemical prestige. Nothing is either good or bad, desirable or undesirable, or anything else, except that it is made so by laboratories inside us producing the emotions on which we live. And to live on our emotions is to live arbitrarily, inaccurately, imparting meaning to what has none of its own. Yet what other way is there to live? Without the ever-clanking machinery of emotion, everything would come to a standstill. There would be nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to be, and no one to know. The alternatives are clear: to live falsely as pawns of affect, or to live factually as depressives, or as individuals who know what is known to the depressive. How advantageous that we are not coerced into choosing one or the other, neither choice being excellent. One look at human existence is proof enough that our species will not be released from the stranglehold of emotionalism that anchors it to hallucinations. That may be no way to live, but to opt for depression would be to opt out of existence as we consciously know it. Of course, individuals may recover from depression, but in that event they had better keep their consciousness of what they went through at heel. Otherwise, they might start thinking that being alive is not as all right as they once thought it was when they were being shuttled about by a relatively well-constituted emotional system. The same applies to bodily systems of any kind, such as the immune system, because when one of your systems goes haywire, you cannot function as you think it should. You may not even be able to think about anything except how much vomit, nasal mucus, phlegm, and watery stool you are discharging from your body when your immune system cannot withstand an onslaught from a viral or bacterial infection. If that is the way you were all the time, you could not go on as a well-constituted being, which means you could not go on as your old self, whatever that might have been. But chances are you will get better after one or more of your systems has gone haywire, and as a newly well-constituted being you will probably think, I'm back to being the real me. However, you might as truthfully think that the real you is the one who was sick, not the one with well-constituted systems working together so cooperatively that you do not even notice them. You cannot go around thinking that the sick you is the real you, though, or you would turn into someone who suffers from chronic anxiety about all the ways your systems can go haywire, and that would become the real you.